Welcome to Distrust and Disparities, Dismantling Black Health Disparities podcast. We examine health disparities that disproportionately affect Black women and Black families. In addition, we amplify organizations and individuals working to dismantle racist health practices and systems to improve health outcomes for marginalized communities. I'm your host, Jasmine Moore, a registered nurse, and I'm joined by my good friend and co-host, Camille White.
These nurses were recruited from far and wide to work at an institution that had a very highly contagious disease. And the patients actually called the nurses who work with them their angels. And since they were predominantly Black, the term stuck, Black angels. I don't know how people view it, but I know that I am pleased that the nurses who worked very hard were excellent nurses who gave a lot of themselves to the work that they did, and many sacrifices, because by working at Seaview Hospital, they were sacrificing their health because any one of them could have become contaminated with tuberculosis.
In this episode, we discuss the courageous and resilient Black nurses who treated patients with the highly contagious tuberculosis and played pivotal roles in discovering the cure for the disease. And we highlight the National Black Nurses Association, serving as the voice for Black nurses in diverse populations, ensuring equal access to professional development, promoting educational opportunities, and improving health.
Welcome back to another episode of Distrust and Disparities. We're glad to be back, and it feels like this year is just zooming on by. We have entered the month of May, and coincidentally, the month of May is also Mental Health Awareness Month. And what a coincidence. You know, like, my mental health has been on a roller coaster, but, you know, I feel like I am, if you know that meme where it's like the dog and he's like sitting in the around like all the fire and he's like, everything is all right.
Yeah.
Right. I feel like I'm trying to gaslight myself into, you know, everything is fine, or, you know, the affirmation, everything will be fine, you know, and just trying to, you know, focus on the things that I can control and just trying my best to be a decent human in this world.
Yeah. Focusing on your mental health is so important, and it's good that we have a month of awareness about it. But of course, we need to be doing it all the time. We need to also be prioritizing rest, like we were talking about earlier, of like intentional guilt-free rest, and not thinking that, like, you know, you need to earn rest or you need to be deserving of it because you did something. Like, no, you just deserve rest because you deserve it. You got up today and you did things. That was enough. And for some people, that could mean you got up and you washed your face. You got up and you brushed your teeth. And if that was all you were able to do, like, kudos to you, because it's hard out here. And, you know, take it one day at a time, and, you know, hopefully things can get better, whatever space you're in. But prioritizing your mental health is just so important. And, you know, we can't say anything else other than that. And, you know, rest.
Yes, it's free. Like, you know, mental health has become so commercialized, but and self-care and all the things they want you to do and buy. But the best thing you can give for your body is to sit your ass down. Go to bed, hydrate yourself, say no to things and people. You know, it's just the simple things that you can do that you need to consistently do just to get out of this cycle of burnout. And If you go back through our episodes, we have specific episodes dedicated to mental health, where we talk about our own mental health. We talk about specific cases surrounding mental health. So go back and listen to some of those episodes. But additionally, the month of May is also Nurses Week, and we want to celebrate all the nurses out there. We want to shout them out.
Jasmine included, because right. If you are new to the podcast or don't remember, Jasmine is a nurse, has been a nurse for quite a while now. So, right. You know, thank you, Jasmine, for all that you have done in your role as a nurse. I know that you have given excellent care, and because you're a Black woman, you're giving, you know, better care than someone else would. And because you're so aware of so many things, I know you're mindful of when you're interacting with people, because you want to make sure when they're at their most vulnerable moment that, like, they feel comfortable in your presence and that, like, you give a damn, because you do. And thank you for that, Jasmine.
Oh, that was really sweet. Like, I got caught up because I was looking at what I wrote. I have literally been a nurse for 10 years, and this October will make 11 years. I'm like, where has that time gone? And in this 10 years, I feel like I've done so many things and worked on mm-hmm. so many different floors, different units, different states. And I also feel like I have experience, but I also feel like there's so much more that I want to do within the nursing field. And, you know, just this podcast has given me the opportunity to explore the history of nursing and also just the medical field. And I just want to be a part of, you know, preventing this constant cycle of just history repeating itself. Just, I don't know what specifically I want to do, but I would like to, you know, I feel like I already am making a difference, but how to continue that? It sounds so mm-hmm. vague, but I'm at a stage where just figuring out how to bridge this podcast and my clinical work together. So I enjoy doing this podcast. I also enjoy interacting with my patients. And I'm also now working in the mental health space. So this has been very eye-opening, and it's been a great experience. So looking to figure out how to learn more about that.
Have you checked out our website? There you can find all of our episodes and show notes. You can even listen directly on the site and catch up on any previous episode you may have missed. You can read our bios and see what we're up to. Also, we made it even easier to contact us. Just fill out the form on our homepage and click submit. We invite you to recommend guests and topics we should feature. So what are you waiting for? Go check us out at distrustanddisparities.com.
So let's segue into this week's story, which highlights some very pivotal Black nurses. For this week's main story, we wanted to discuss the Black nurses that answered the call to work at a New York hospital that specifically cared for patients with the deadly tuberculosis infection. Tuberculosis is one of the oldest and deadliest diseases. And lucky for us, it can be prevented and cured. Just to get an understanding of how deadly it is, tuberculosis is currently the second deadliest infection globally, and it's only second behind COVID. So that just shows like how contagious it is. And tuberculosis, and we'll also call it TB throughout this episode. It's a brutal infection that affects all parts of the body, but mostly the lungs, where it eats away at the tissue. It is easily passed along from person to person because it's an airborne germ, and it lies dormant until you start to notice, till it gets to the point where you start to see these deadly symptoms. And victims grow progressively short of breath. They end up coughing up blood and choking as they waste away. And many languish with fevers. And before there was a cure, they underwent grisly medical procedures in hopes of stopping the advance of the disease. And on average, patients suffer for about 270 days before their deaths. And this was just in gruesome pain. Like we said, they're coughing up blood, they're unable to breathe, so they're not eating and things like that. And in 1912, the drug ionazide, which turned out to be the cure for the disease, was discovered, but it would take up to 40 years before the drug's actual clinical use in 1952. And around 60 million people died of the disease in that time frame. And history often leaves out the pivotal role that Black women, Black nurses played in working on TB sanatoriums when very few individuals wanted to put their life on the line to work with some of the sickest patients. And we're going to dive into this story. At the turn of the last century, about 10,000 people a year were dying of tuberculosis in New York City alone. In an effort to limit the spread of the disease, New York City Health Commissioner proposed treating all of the city's TB patients in a single hospital rather than multiple TB wards throughout the city. This resulted in the creation of Seaview Hospital on Staten Island. It was built in 1914, and it eventually grew from one building to eight buildings. And one of the buildings was a residency for staff nurses. And Staten Island is one of New York City's, it's like the furthest borough in New York. So it's kind of very separated from the other islands, such as Manhattan, Brooklyn, and things like that. And this Seaview Hospital, this sanatorium operated from 1913 to 1961. And by the 1920s, the annual TB death rate was dropping, and it dropped by half. However, the sickest patients still remained at Seaview for years. And many of the patients were immigrants, and most were poor. The hospital was chronically underfunded and overcrowded. Additionally, it was also understaffed, particularly when it came to nurses. Staff retention was a major problem. The work at Seaview was dangerous because tuberculosis, like we said, is an airborne infection. So many people could become infected and end up suffering from the disease. So the hospital had a high turnover rate. But in 1921, the hospital experienced a large mass exodus of white nurses beginning in that spring. They quit in large numbers, and no one knows exactly why the nurses left. Some speculate that it was cut because of the commute from, say, the city to the island of Staten Island. But Arthur Maria Smilos, she summarizes that working white women had plenty of options for jobs that wouldn't kill them, including sales clerks, cashiers, stenographers, secretaries, librarians, and telephone operators. They had the luxury of, you know, quitting and working somewhere else. And this resulted in the hospital being on the brink of closure by the 1930s. And emergency meetings were called to discuss who would replace the Seaview nurses. And an idea emerged. They were like, we should hire Black nurses to work here. Like, if, you know, the white women won't do it, we'll see if we can get Black nurses to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just interesting.
Very interesting. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. So we'll keep going. We'll keep going. Mm-hmm. And it just reminds me, I know I just said I'm gonna keep going, but it just reminds me of some of like the readings I'm reading from Bell Hooks and Audre Lorde, and, you know, just how, you know, Black women come to the rescue, oftentimes take jobs that, you know, nobody else wants, and just constantly in this caregiver role. And mm-hmm. yeah, we see it a lot, and it still continues to this day. So let's continue on discussing this story. In 1929, the Commissioner of Health had the idea of advertising in the Deep South for Black nurses to come up north to support Seaview Hospital and, you know, some other hospitals. Ads were placed in newspapers and even in church bulletins in many states across the South. And during this time, it also coincides with the Great Migration, which had brought thousands of Southern workers north to work in factories and steel mills, and also as cooks or domestics. However, nursing wasn't the same kind of labor because the lines of segregation had left a lot of Black nurses unemployed. In 1929, there were only 260 Black hospitals versus approximately 6,000 white hospitals. And in the Jim Crow South, hospitals were largely segregated in the 1920s. And those that served Black patients lacked the financial resources to hire staff nurses. Instead, they relied on student trainees and inadvertently producing a large number of Black nurses with few places to put their skills to work. There were limited job opportunities outside of domestic work for many Black women. Additionally, Black nurses were often barred from other hospitals. In New York specifically, only 4 out of the 29 hospitals in the city would hire Black nurses. So this resulted in high unemployment rates for Black nurses during this time. So many nurses from the South came up to work in the Northern hospitals, as well as some of the nurses already in the city were able to get some more opportunities. And what also drew a lot of nurses to this opportunity, employment at Seaview Hospital included room and board, nursing education, and on-the-job training. And up north, the environment was slightly less oppressive as compared to the Jim Crow discrimination they experienced in the South. Like, I had to do some digging, but this was worded like completely different. They was like, oh, it was much better in the North. But I'm like, I think slightly less oppressive, or a different kind of oppression and racism, you know?
Yeah. The Civil War and the Union and the Confederacy and like, which side were you on? And it's just like, just because you happen to be up north, you think like people automatically want to assume it's better up there. And it's like, no, there's racism all over this country, this world. And it was all over, especially them. And no, they might have not had like as many Jim Crow laws and discrimination, but they still existed up in the North. I think it's just like we see the South as like this big, bad, racist area when it's just like it was still the whole country. It was still.
Yes.
let's not be delusional now and view it in rose colored glasses of like, oh, the North is just so much better. Like there were some pros. And there, that was why, you know, even say like, I feel like our ancestors came up here. Like, I know that's how like my family ended up in like Baltimore, but like, let's not be delusional, people.
Like we just pointed out, only 4 out of the 29 hospitals in New York would hire Black nurses. And we're going to discuss some of the things, some of the differences. Yes, Black women, they had access to employment, but they're also working in
severely understaffed in very dangerous situations. And Black nurses were paid only about 3/4 of what the hospital's white nurses earned. One of the Black nurses interviewed stated she was paid $720 a year. And she pointed out this far exceeded what she could have accomplished working in Georgia. But the remaining white nurses at CVU earned $1,100 annually. So you have the pay difference. Black nurses also didn't receive any promotions. Even when more white nurses left the hospitals to go into private duty careers. So instead of like promoting them, they ended up working consecutive double shifts. And they were forced to work under rigid and racist nursing supervisors. One of the Black nurses that worked at CVU, Virginia Allen, she recalled, "There were only a few Caucasian supervisors. They rarely visit the units. They had almost no contact with patients. They worked in the front office." So here you kind of clearly see the divide. They're kind of just ordering the Black nurses around, and they're, you know, not having to take care of these highly contagious patients. Additionally, there were signs in the dining room that had reserved for whites only. And once they left the hospital, they faced overt hostility from their white neighbors in Staten Island. They were ostracized by the residents, who sneered and shunned them on public transportation. And all this is going on in the midst of an extremely hostile work environment. These Black nurses still had to care for some of the city's sickest patients. So conditions were very difficult and the risks were very high. The job was not only dangerous, but also physically and emotionally challenging due to the rigors of the highly contagious disease. Because as we pointed out at the beginning, it affects patients' lungs. So, and if it progresses, patients are unable to take care of themselves, unable to control their bodily functions. And then sometimes when people are in their right state of mind, just imagine patients acting out. And then some of the patients were, you know, white patients, and they're physically abusive to the nurses who are taking care of them because they are Black as well. So you have that on top of that. And there were approximately 150 Black nurses for about 12,000 patients. And that's just one of the ratios, but basically patients outnumbered the number of nurses. We'll say what, like 10 to 1? Excuse my math if that's wrong, but, you know, close to 1,300 patients and anywhere from 150 nurses. I think the max I read was maybe there might have been like 300 nurses. And the systemic racism inflicted on the nurses was pervasive and personal. The racism also infused into local and national organizations. I just wanted to point this out because I thought this was just crazy. Like we stated earlier, in New York, the Department of Hospitals only allowed Black nurses to work in 4 of its 29 facilities. When pushed to integrate the other hospitals, the commissioner chillingly admitted why he favored keeping CVU mostly Black. So this is a quote. This is what he says. "In 20 years, he stated in 1934, we won't have a colored problem in the United States of America because they'll all be dead of tuberculosis."
Oh, Lord.
This is what he said.
This is the health commissioner,
yes,
of the New York Department of Hospitals?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Oh. It should have been New York Department of Hospitals for, you know, white patients.
Yeah.
He should white have specified only. That.
White people only, and will employ Black people hoping that they catch contagious diseases and die.
and basically take them home and like spread it. It just comes back to the fact you're like, oh, why you guys always bring out race? Why you always bring out racism? But if you look at the history of these health departments, these health systems, you see why people say these systems weren't designed for us. Like this statement alone clearly exemplifies this. Like these systems weren't designed to take care of us. It's about benefiting, you know, white patients and caring for them. And it's just really sad. And it's sad because it's, you know, it's still like this. And it makes me think, how do we fix a broken system? How do we fix a system that was not designed for us?
Dismantle it. Start anew. Start right. again. And right. I know it's like easy to say, but it's so difficult to do. But like, truly, if like what we want to see is like improvements for everyone, it really is dismantling the system. Because again, too, like you had to point out of like when researching, they were like, oh, it was better in the North. How, sweetie? How would it be better? And then like you even going like, it was slightly better. And it's like, yes, okay, someone could admit that like, oh, they wouldn't have made the same amount of money in Georgia, but then you look at the white women doing the same exact job, or wait, some supervisors who weren't even really doing anything but being nasty, getting paid more money than they were. And then you have this person that's literally like, I hope they all like die of tuberculosis. Like how it's everywhere, and it's terrible. And it really is like we need to tear it all down and start anew and make sure that we're training the people coming in to do these jobs to be as inclusive and anti-racist and all the things, like, you know, not transphobic, not queerphobic, not like just, and it's so difficult to do that because like we have trainings and like diversity, equity, inclusion, but then it's like, oh wait, they're getting rid of that.
And people need to know this history. Like, why wasn't I taught this in school? Was not taught this in school at all. Like, I would love one day to, you know, just teach a course, trainings on this information, because it truly impacts, I would say, you know, it impacts me. I'm deeply moved, and just seeing like the work that Black nurses did. And, you know, I hope other people feel inspired, and also they're like, I don't want this shit to happen again. Like, this does not need to happen again. You know, that's what we want people to walk away feeling. So it's like, we need this information. People need to be educated. They need to share this information, because we don't want to keep repeating this. And that's what the health commissioner said back in the 1920s, 1930s, the American Nurse Association, like the American Medical Association, didn't allow Black members. And this led to the formation of the National Association of Colored Graduate Nurses. And this association was helpful in helping many of CVU's Black nurses assume leadership positions like later on down the line. So we had to basically, like you said, create our own organizations to advocate and fight for us and to help to dismantle some of these systems.
So now we're going to talk about the timeline of like moving into the cure for TB and then the clinical trials that were conducted at CVU Hospital. Despite enduring racism, sexism, and physical abuse from patients, most of the Black nurses worked day after day handling them and dealing with the deadly disease that had no cure. For the next three decades, Black nurses became the backbone of CVU and informally became known as the Black Angels. Then in the summer of 1951, CVU began testing a new antibiotic on the hospital's sickest patients. In a matter of weeks, their health was largely restored without the side effects or rebounds produced by some earlier drugs. Then the trials were expanded, doses were adjusted, and the antibiotic was tested in combination with other drugs. And the work of Seaview's physicians and nurses led to a historic breakthrough, the discovery of a cocktail of treatments that were 95% effective in ensuring recovery from TB. And when the cure for TB was discovered, Dr. Edward Robizek, who led those efforts at Seaview, he credited the Black nurses for the successful trials of the antibiotics, saying they ran the wards. Seaview was eventually closed as more and more patients recovered and went home. And over the same period, more nursing programs and hospitals across the country admitted Black nurses. Then the American Nurses Association, which Jasmine mentioned earlier, which had excluded Black nurses for decades, finally welcomed them, leading to the dissolution of the National Association of Colored Graduate Nurses in 1951, because they were, quote, now American nurses, not Negro nurses, which is like hard eye roll with that. Hard eye roll. And again, it's like it took this doctor acknowledging and crediting these Black nurses for their work, their hard work, their effort in running these TB wards and these clinical trials, for then other people to be like, oh, I guess they are, you know, nurses and people that are deserving of being hired in these spaces and working and acknowledged and being welcomed into associations and stuff. But like, it's so frustrating that like people couldn't just acknowledge that on their own. You had to be what, told by a white man that, oh, these Black women are, you know, deserving, even though they've been doing all this and like doing it, not just like doing a job and like going home and like they weren't experiencing anything negative. Like they were abused physically and mentally by patients, by their coworkers, like they survivors. They were survivors.
Exactly. And I would say, I would add the word, you know, figuratively. Yes, he did say this quote, but oftentimes when you look at the history of the clinical trials of TB, this is left out. You know, we don't see that quote. We, like you said, we don't hear of what the Black nurses endured, what they went through, how they answered the call when, you know, white nurses basically left and said, you know, we don't have to deal with this. You know, we're not taking care of this patient. They left in droves. And then Black women came in, stepped in and worked in probably with crazy ratios, taking care of some of the sickest patients that we know of. And also we're thinking, like, as I was doing this story and, you know, I knew I wanted to talk about this for Nurses Week, it's just like, why am I just learning about this? Like, why wasn't I taught this in school? And mind you, I went to a HBCU, Camille, a historically Black college. I was not taught this. Was not taught this. Just found out. Like we've been discussing, for decades, the contributions of Black figures to the history of medicine and just to America as a whole has often been ignored or purposely marginalized. And I would say even that, like the struggles people endured while they are, you know, making these contributions is definitely left out. And more we are learning about the stories and amazing contributions that Black people have made to the healthcare field and various other fields. And in 2015, Maria Smilos, who is a biomedical editor at Springer Publishing, she stumbled upon the statement, "The cure for tuberculosis was found at Seaview Hospital in Staten Island." And this caught her interest, and she spent about 7 years researching the full story of Seaview. And that's when she learned about the Black nurses and how they were called Black angels and the pivotal role that they played at the hospital. So she ended up writing a book called The Black Angels, and she recounts the amazing histories, talking about nursing during that period, race relations. She also gets into the disease pathology of TB and also the cure for TB. And we want to point out that books like The Black Angels do a great service in telling forgotten stories about race and forces, I'll say, white people to explore why they are forgotten, because I think, you know, we know, but, you know, it's kind of for them. Mm-hmm. And an article points out that Maria Smilo, she does a terrific job of rescuing largely forgotten historical figures and correcting incomplete and at times misleading historical accounts. Like we mentioned, there was a lot of articles and even books written about the 1951 trials of the medication Izazide, but they leave out the Black nurses. She does give Black nurses such as Ina Sutton and Virginia Allen, two pivotal nurses, the opportunity to share their stories, and they are being celebrated and acknowledged. That's how we know about these nurses to this day. So that's why we have this podcast, so that we can share stories and just share and pass on information as well.
If you are enjoying this episode, you should consider buying us a coffee. Yes, a coffee. That small gesture will help us continue to create quality episodes and content. Click the Buy Me a Coffee link in the show notes or check out our website at distrustanddisparities.com. One of the firsthand accounts that is mentioned in the book is from Virginia Allen, who Jasmine mentioned earlier. And Virginia was born in 1931, and she said that she had always wanted to be a nurse because, quote, "I would see my Aunt Edna in her nurse's whites, and I was inspired." And in 1947, at a mere 16 years old, during a dire nursing shortage, Edna invited her to come to Seaview, where she was hired as a nurse's aide in the children's hospital. And some said it was, quote, "the saddest place on earth," but Virginia remembers her time there fondly. And here's a quote from Virginia. "To be perfectly frank, I had no fear, and I didn't realize how deadly tuberculosis was. Unlike some of the Black angels who came before her, she has fond memories of her years at Seaview. The working conditions were pleasant, and I enjoyed working with children. I found it a challenge, not a chore. I was learning every day." And fortunately, she began working during the golden age of antibiotics, where more treatments were available for those sick with TB. So in 1952, she, and along with her other co-workers, became part of a galvanizing moment in history. And the antibiotic trials, which ushered in a cure for tuberculosis. And although the children were not a part of the trial, Virginia was privy to this long-awaited moment, and it was very exciting for her to see more patients going home. And following her work at Seaview, Virginia graduated from the School for Practical Nursing as an LPN and embarked on a long career in nursing. She also became deeply involved in civil rights in her community. And once she retired from nursing, she remained an essential part of her Staten Island community. She served on various boards. She championed women's issues and continued to advocate for education reform and youth development. And Virginia is one of the last surviving Black angels at 93 years old. So she is still alive today. And she currently resides at Park Lane at Seaview, a private retirement home, which was originally the Seaview Hospital Nurses Residence. And the building was renovated in 2009. And Virginia now makes her home on the same floor of the same building where she lived in the late 1940s. Which is like such a circular moment where it's like, right,
she's sort of finishing out her life where like it really sort of took off and she was able to pursue her dreams. And that's just so wonderful for Virginia.
And it's amazing. She's alive today and telling her story. And, mm-hmm. you know, I'm glad we have the opportunity to share her story and also inspire other nurses out there. Like, it's hard, but you are making a difference. You may not see it, may not feel it, but you are making a difference, and continue to go and give 100% for your patients, but also give 100% for yourself as well. Celebrate yourself after each shift, and you know that you are out here doing your best, because times still are hard. We still have staffing ratios are still insane, and sometimes working conditions are not the safest for both patients and for nurses. And we're going to segue into the second part of our show, the last part, where we highlight organizations working to dismantle basically racist healthcare practices and systems. And we want to highlight the National Black Nurses Association. We highlighted them before, but I think it's still very relevant, and we want to let nurses know that there is an organization for Black nurses out here, and we want people to join or even donate to these organizations. And the National Black Nurses Association, it was organized in 1971 under the leadership of Dr. Lorianne Sams. She was the former dean and professor of nursing at Tuskegee University in Alabama. And the National Black Nurses Association, their mission is to provide a forum for collective action by African American nurses to represent and provide a forum for Black nurses to advocate for and implement strategies to ensure access to the highest quality of healthcare for persons of color. And the association is committed to excellence in education and conducts continuing education programs for nurses, allied health professionals throughout the year. They also provide annual scholarships to its members. I encourage, like I said at the beginning, if you are a Black nurse out there, to get a membership. They have local chapters and just be a part of it. Additionally, like I said, you should join the Black Nurses, or you can also donate to the cause, support them, share their research, and share their events that they're having. Also, we're going to include in our show notes a link to a list of various HBCUs with nursing programs. Like I said, I went to Delaware State University and I graduated from their nursing program, and just to learn from other, you know, Black teachers and also Black students. It was nice just to be in that environment, but do your research, look up the right school, right program for you. And nursing is hard, but it does come with rewards and joys. But I hope you enjoyed our discussion of the Black Angels, and just learn about Virginia Allen and her contributions to the field of nursing and how she took care of tuberculosis patients when there was not a cure. So nurses, make sure you celebrate yourself for the hard work that you're doing. And it may seem difficult at times. Try to find an outlet to, you know, make time for yourself, and also an outlet to advocate for the change that you want to see. I feel like my contribution is through this podcast and just sharing information and stories. And this is helping me grow and creating a bridge. But, you know, figure out what you can do on your end. And even if it's just going to work and giving 100% and taking care of your patients how you would want your family to be treated, that is enough in itself. So, thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode.
Do you have recommendations for topics we should discuss about health disparities or injustices? Guests we should interview doing amazing health justice work? Or organizations we should highlight creating positive change for marginalized communities? Please visit us at distrustanddisparities.com or email us at distrustanddisparities@gmail.com. Remember to subscribe, rate, and review us wherever you listen to podcasts. And follow us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and LinkedIn. Thank you.